Next case for argument is Mulcahy Porritt from Salvador versus Commissioner of Internal Revenue, Mr. Hartman.
Thank you, Judge Posner, and may it please the Court. The tax court's ruling in this case is incompatible with Exacto Spring and the later ruling in Menard, Inc., and is incorrect for two reasons. We aim this morning to take up those two reasons. We must rely on our briefs as to the other points of disagreements between the parties. Distilled to its essence, the first reason that the tax court ruling is incorrect is that it missed the fundamental premise of Exacto Spring. The need for objectivity in judging deductibility requires the use of a benchmark derived from the market.
I don't know what you're saying, but let me ask a different question. this firm does have physical capital, not a lot, but obviously has physical capital, such as the money that these partners leave in the company at the end of the year, and they have desks and computers and goodness knows what else. So that means that some of their income must be a return on this capital, right?
I don't think so, Your Honor, for the following reason.
Well, let me ask you, is there a balance sheet somewhere?
There is a balance sheet.
What does it show about their assets?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Well, you don't know what's in your own balance sheet?
As I said,
that's pathetic. I mean, we're talking about whether they have capital and earnings on capital, so I didn't see a balance sheet. You say there is a balance sheet, but you don't know what's in it.
What if they
have $1 million in capital, right?
But it doesn't, Your Honor.
You don't know what's in the balance sheet.
I cannot recount it here, Your Honor. That's correct.
Well, there's some positive number in the balance sheet for assets, right?
Right.
And why isn't that? If they leave money in the company, they're adding to its capital, they want a return on their capital, even if it's a small amount, and some return would be imputed as, you know, dividends.
It's small, Your Honor.
Of course it's small, but even if it's a penny, you're in serious trouble, right?
I don't think so for the following reason, Your Honor. What we are looking to do is measure how effective these founders are as managers of...
The IRS wants to know. I don't want to know, but the IRS wants to know how much of their income should be allocated to return on physical capital. I mean, you're certainly right. A company like this, most of its capital is human capital, not physical capital, and human capital isn't treated as physical capital, but there is some physical capital. That's all the IRS is saying. These people have to allocate some of their income, even if very small, to the physical capital. They leave $2,000 in the company at the end of the year. Well, let's say 5%. 5% is what, $10? $100. But it's $100. So that $100 in their income was a dividend. That's all its case involves, as far as I tell.
We see the case as involving what's the appropriate benchmark from the market to measure.
Let me answer my question. If one of these people adds $2,000 to the physical capital of the company, shouldn't we impute, say, $100 of his annual income to this capital investment he's made? 5% return on equity capital is actually very low. That'd be a minimum estimate. But there it is. As far as the IRS is concerned, if you fail to report any zero dividend income, then you're cheating the government.
What our expert testified to, Your Honor, was that
Your expert said he doesn't know anything about taxes.
Correct.
Your expert also said this was an extraordinarily profitable company.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which would suggest that maybe there's some taxable profit somewhere there. Is that a reasonable inference?
No, it's not, because the demand here for this corporation is to make sure that its workers are satisfied. That means paying them compensation so that they don't leave the firm.
So why not measure the, if we have to allocate the founder's compensation between, in essence, compensation for services and profits from their investment in the company, why not look to the highest paid non-shareholder employees' compensation as a benchmark?
Because the expert says that's not the appropriate comparison to draw, Your Honor.
Right, and neither did the tax court judge. He was not satisfied that that was sufficient either. Let me ask you, Mr. Hartnett, the tax court judge referred to the Supreme Court's opinion in National Alfalfa, Dehydrating and Milling Company, for the proposition that while the taxpayer is free to organize his affairs as he chooses, nevertheless, once having done so, he must accept the tax consequences of his choice, whether contemplated or not. And it looks to me like that's what the trial court did here, is in essence hold you all to the choice of a C corporation and the choice of treating all of this as something other than compensation.
No, Your Honor, first of all, I accept the proposition that the tax court cited National Alfalfa for, but the way we see this is what's going on here is there is simply a deduction taken for compensation, and the issue is whether that deduction is reasonable.
No, the deduction was taken for so-called consulting services provided. None of this was treated as employee compensation in the way that the company managed its affairs. That's why the National Alfalfa reasoning might apply here, to say, this is the way you all did it. We're holding you to the way you did it.
But the notice of deficiency, Your Honor, aggregates those issues. What they said in the notice, and I'm paraphrasing it now, is it's determined that the deduction for compensation and consulting fees exceeds a reasonable amount for salaries. Everybody knew that those payments to the for the consulting fees were essentially coming back to the founders in this case.
Well, the tax court judge said, as I understood him, gave two alternative explanations here. One is you can deduct under 162A expenses that you designate as consulting services and for which you do not, you know, file a W-2, pay employment taxes, and so on. And we don't have to go any further than that. Then he went a further and developed an alternative theory. Let's pretend we bypass these related entities, assume the payments are made directly to the founders personally, and even then you didn't meet your burden of proof. But you've got to beat both of those theories.
But as to the former, Your Honor, I don't think that was the basis of the tax court's decision. The way the opinion read, and it's confusing and it's not entirely clear, but the tax court judge did not reach the issue of, we've got these payments for the consulting fees. Instead, he went right to the question of, even if you accept that.
The firm, page 12 of the tax court's opinion, the firm concedes that no services were rendered by the related entities. Therefore, the firm is not entitled to deduct the consulting fee payments as payments for services rendered by the related entities.
And to that we say, Your Honor, the tax court clearly erred in making that finding. Mr. Salvador, the managing partner, testified that they provided services to the clients of the firm through those entities. And there is no...
Why didn't they withhold any taxes? Why didn't the company withhold taxes?
The payments were paid right into the founders, Your Honor, in our reply brief at pages 4 and 5.
But they are employees, aren't they?
Correct, Your Honor. But I can assure you that when you look at our reply brief at pages 4 to 5, we totally deal with the question of there's some kind of tax avoidance or tax evasion.
Somebody paid employment tax on all that.
Correct.
That's clear. The only issue here has to do with the double taxation by choosing to organize as a C corporation, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And so what's wrong with holding the company to the form of the transactions that it chose?
The form of the transactions is correct. It's the substance, really, that ought to govern. That's a fundamental precept of tax law.
Well, it is in some tension with the idea from National Alfalfa that we'll hold you to the form that you choose.
I think that's right. But viewing this with an eye toward practicality, what we're talking about here is, were those bonus payments reasonable compensation?
Well, the eye towards practicality would say, why didn't you guys organize as a subchapter S or a partnership, right? Because you're asking, in essence, to be treated as if you were a subchapter S or a partnership, to have the same degree of flexibility to be able to cash out everything and not incur any taxation at the corporate level.
It's a legitimate point to make, Your Honor.
And the answer is?
I don't have an answer for that. That was the way in which the taxpayer elected to do business.
They were concealing their incomes from their subordinate. Look, you don't answer my question on pages 4 and 5 of your reply brief. You say there was no underpayment of taxes. That's fine. I'm asking a different question. Why was there no withholding?
I believe that because they were received W-2s for that income.
Pardon? I'm maybe simple-minded. Employees have to withhold, and these people are employees. Why don't they have to with estimated income tax and so on, right?
Correct, Your Honor. And I don't have an answer for you. I do know there's no.
And how can you have employees who don't withhold? Then their employer doesn't withhold. I don't get that.
I do know they picked up all of the income and the.
No, I'm not saying they underpaid their taxes. You can pay your taxes in full without even filing an income tax return, right? You just send a check.
That's right, Your Honor.
It's not
still
recommended.
Extremely irregular, right? All right. So why didn't they file withhold? Why didn't the company file? Withhold part of their income for taxes?
I don't have an answer. In retrospect, I'm sure that they wouldn't treat their tax affairs this way, knowing what they now know.
And I don't understand these intermediate entities. I don't get that.
The expert set forth in his report, Your Honor, that the purpose of the intermediate entities was to meet certain regulatory and licensing requirements. Essentially, what we've got here is a firm engaging in multidisciplinary practice, and it's expanding beyond the ordinary accounting world.
I see.
Your Honors, I see the light is on. I believe that my time is up.
You have only
we're
one
eating
red
into
light
your rebuttal time is what you're doing.
Thank you, Your Honor. We would like to leave you with this idea that Exacto and Menard were decided in order to bring order to the chaos of the multi-factor test.
But Exacto and Menard both deal with you look to the return that a passive investor would get, right?
Correct.
We don't have any passive investors
here. And that's precisely our point, Your Honor. The expert says, in that case, we have to look to gross revenue. That's the metric.
That's preposterous. Gross revenue as a measure here is of the reasonableness of compensation is ridiculous.
What if the company's costs exceeded its revenues? Would you still say the company was worth its revenues? That would be so ridiculous. You're not going to say that. Suppose I have revenues of $1 million and has expenses of $900,000. So would you say the company is worth $1 million or $100,000 or some multiple of $100,000 or what?
The expert says it's $1 million in that case.
Oh, come on. How can something be worth $1 million? I mean, suppose it has $1 million in revenues and has $2 million in costs. So is it still worth $1 million?
Our expert says yes, Your Honor.
But that's ridiculous.
But I'm not in the position
to... That's ridiculous. Will you agree it is ridiculous to have a company that has negative profits to have a positive value?
With all due respect, Your Honor, I cannot agree with that.
Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Ashford?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Tamara Ashford on behalf of the Commission on Return of Revenue. This is a burden of proof case, and in this case, as the tax court, Judge Morrison, found, the taxpayer didn't satisfy its burden of proving not only under 162 that the payment of consulting fees to the related entities was reasonable, but that they were compensatory in nature. And what I mean by that is compensation for actual services rendered. Indeed, as we have noted in our brief, and as Your Honor has specifically stated in Exacto, the purpose of 162 is to prevent corporations from disguising non-deductible dividends as deductible compensation.
But in the context, I frankly have trouble translating Exacto, Spring, and Menard to the context here of professional services. This taxpayer may have chosen the most convoluted let us say, at least subtle way of concealing compensation to founders from other people involved in the company. But I'm concerned about how our decision in this case might affect a lot of other similarly situated taxpayers who have to choose how to manage compensation in a professional services context where they've got a subchapter C corporation. How should we do that?
Sure. Well, let me, Judge Hamilton, address your question with 2 points. Okay. First, appellant counsel would sort of ask for Exacto, Spring, and Menard to be modified, and my response to that is that they missed the mark with respect to the point of Exacto, Spring. And in particular, we point this out on page 43 of our brief. We submit to you that in Exacto, the court declined to question the reasonableness of compensation paid to a shareholder manager for his services because the corporation had net income. It was of more than $1 million per year, despite the fact that the shareholder manager was paid a salary of, $1 to $1.3 million, and then the net income represented an annual rate of return on equity of more than 20% as compared to, the benchmark of 13%. And my second point in answering your question is the Exacto Spring, the hypothetical investor test, it's not limited to the consideration of the corporation's rate of return on equity. You all, Judge Posner, you point out that the payment must also be a bona fide expense here. And again, the taxpayer did not prove that.
Here's the problem, okay? A company like this, I'm more familiar with it from a private law firm that was a pass-through entity as far as taxation went. But you don't know at the beginning of the year or halfway through the year as you're distributing cash to live on, you don't know ultimately how much the firm's profits are going to be for the year. How should we look at the way a subchapter C corporation handles that? One way to do it is just to say, well, look at how the corporation labels the payments, and that works for you all in this case, where the founders took out relatively modest salaries through the year and then took the big chunk of cash from the middle of the table on December 31st and went through these related entities. But should we look, in essence, just at labels there, or should we do something more subtle?
Well, I think, Your Honor, again, it goes back to actual services rendered and being able to keep, in particular, as a C corporation, being able to keep adequate books and records to be able to demonstrate the value and nature of the services, what portion of that, does relate to, say, profit And the other, and then the other would be with respect to, you know, actual, say, you know, billings and services. So again, in the context of, you know, a law firm, you have, you know, the partners. But there are clearly, you know, non-shareholders. So you have, you know, associates, you have counsel, and clearly they are also providing value.
There benchmarks? So for law firms that are organized in not strictly corporate form, but some kind of limited liability form, are there some benchmarks as to how much of a law firm's or how much of the partner's receipts in a law firm should be attributed to, should be treated as dividends?
I'm not aware of, Your Honor. I mean, certainly in Exacto Spring, you know, the benchmark, I mean, you know, was set at something, you know, above 10%. Certainly, if you look at, as we pointed out in our brief, the evidence actually was very scant. There was really no evidence, sort of as, you know, what the shareholders' equity was in this corporation. But sort of doing the mechanical exercise as Exacto Spring and Menard require, taxpayers' return on equity, the ratio for all 3 years at issue, 2001, 2002, and 2003, was, you know, was below 1%, which is completely not reasonable. And then further to my point, I would just add, is that it's objectively not reasonable, these payments, where you have the three founding shareholders, they solely comprise the compensation committee of the corporation.
Well, when you say 1% is too low, but we don't really know. Maybe it's in the balance sheet that your opponent is not remembering. But maybe their capital is really minute, right? The capital could be so minute. But I guess, they never presented an estimate of what their physical capital is?
I believe that is correct, Your Honor. I just was looking because, as I mentioned, I'm sorry, at pages 40 and 41 of our brief, I just wanted to point out in a footnote 10, they do sort of make the vague reference to the fact that the founding shareholders sort of left a, quote, significant amount of working capital in the corporation over the years. And, of course, we submit that if that were true, then taxpayer shareholders' equity would have been significantly more than the $5,100 in the years at issue. They each contributed $500
I see.
So
$1,500 is it the $1,500 that...
That was the initial capitalization in 1979 or so, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
$1,500 was the what I see, and then they add every year, apparently.
Correct. Correct. Pardon me. Let me also just address because counsel raised it, the expert report that they introduced, or the expert that they used, Mr. Rosenberg. Let me just address very briefly the usefulness, or quite frankly, non-usefulness, of the expert report in a survey. Certainly, as the tax court correctly found, it was useless for several reasons. One, it did not Mr. Rosenberg did not include the information that was required by this court in Menard. Again, for details of that, I reference our brief at page 49. Again, I also point out that, interestingly, I didn't point it out before, but Mr. Rosenberg actually testified at trial that the services performed by the founding shareholders were irrelevant to his analysis. And in addition, I will say that he also did not distinguish between profit distributions and compensation for services. And as Judge Posner, my final point with respect to the usefulness of Mr. Rosenberg's report and testimony is that he specifically testified that he did not know anything about taxation.
The concern that I have here, I guess, Ms. Ashford, is that we can tell from Rosenberg's opinion that just in the world of Chicago area CPAs, the total compensation that Mr. Mulcahy and the others received was sort of within general bounds in terms of the quality of services provided, the professional skills, the training, and so on. If they were to go out in the market as employees somewhere. And there's no indication here of any tax avoidance in the sense of money was concealed from the IRS. The only issue is at the extra level of corporate profit taxation, right? So
correct.
Why is this a big deal for you all, and how do we decide this case in such a way that it provides some useful and non-harmful guidance for other professional services corporations organized as subchapter C corporations?
Judge Hamilton, it's a very big deal for the service, particularly the way the taxpayer and the founding shareholders chose to arrange their business affairs.
They easily could avoid this whole issue by just organizing as a subchapter S or a limited partnership, right?
Correct, but actually what I was trying to say was with respect to the related entities. Mm-hmm. That's very disturbing that the function of these entities, and in fact I will point out that two of the entities, PEM, PEM, and Financial Alternatives, their stated business activity and service is real estate investment and consulting. And further, I would point out that taxpayer admitted that the payments paid, for example, to PEM were return on capital, which was corroborated by Mr. Salvador's testimony. And back to getting to what my point is, Your Honor, is that it's very disturbing for the service where you basically have one personal services firm getting a deduction, an additional benefit, and siphoning off, its profits to a related corporation that are controlled, by the by the accounting firm. That's very troubling. That's very troubling.
What you're saying is that through these related entities, they're actually engaged in a different business as well as accounting. So they're not just accountants getting their standard fees for being
right.
accountants. They're also getting some real estate income.
Right. And, Your Honor, quite frankly, I think, again, it's a case by case. It's a case by case examining the facts of each case. So maybe that also goes to my second point, sort of in answering your question, is that how I think this court can provide guidance, so to speak, to personal services corporations. These cases are very fact specific, and in this particular case, it's all about the burden of proof. And here, there was a dearth of evidence that was
put forth. So, when the expert looked at their draw from the firm and said that this was comparable to what other accountants make, he didn't actually look at how much of that income was generated by their accounting and how much by this real estate?
I believe that is correct. And in fact, so that analysis
may not really be such great accountants, but may owe a significant part of their income to investment in real estate. Is that
and Your Honor, Judge Rosenberg's Mr. Rosenberg's analysis is completely contrary not only to the Treasury regulations, but also the points that are made in Menard.
Look at their actual services.
Exactly, as compared. Exactly, you have to look at the deep.
So how is a professional services corporation supposed to distinguish between compensation for services rendered for its founders, senior partners, etc., shareholders, and the profits that are distributed to them?
Well, I think, again, sort of with my own personal experience in the context of, a law firm, I think, you can certainly attempt to do an allocation, so to speak, with respect to billing, billable hours.
Law firms are almost always, in my experience, pass-through entities, so this issue doesn't even arise. But with business consulting firms and engineering firms and other things like that, you've got a problem here. And how are they supposed to solve it? This solution, we know, didn't fly with the tax court and with the service, but what would?
Well, I think, I mean, you know, again, I think going back to the lessons or from Menard and Exacto Spring, you know, it is about the hypothetical, you know, investor, and I think even a personal services corporation can do the analysis of, you know, the ratio of the net income after taxes to the shareholders, to the shareholders' equity.
Bill on an hourly basis?
Pardon me, I'm sorry.
Do accountants bill on an hourly basis?
I don't know. And in this particular case, there was no evidence or record whatsoever of what their billable rates were.
But if Rosenberg had looked, suppose they bill on an hourly basis. Suppose he had looked at their hourly, their total number of hours, and divided their total draw from the company by the total number of hours. And suppose it's, you know, $100 an hour. And he said that, well, that's what accountants in Chicago charge. Then that would be a permissible approach, wouldn't it? And it could even be that they could have a negative return on their physical capital, right? So, So wouldn't that be legit? I mean, this is really following up on what Judge Hamilton was saying. If Rosenberg, instead of saying he was indifferent to their services, if he'd actually valued their services as accountants, not as real estate investors, then wouldn't that be a satisfactory way of determining what their salary income was?
Sort of yes for the hesitation. I would say it's not a complete analysis because that may be the case if it was literally this accounting firm was just the three of them. But you have here other shareholders who also do work, provide value. You also have non-shareholders that also do work and provide value. And so you're going to have to get further into the weeds, so to speak, and do a more complete analysis.
So the kind of standard, what I recall from many years ago, but probably still true, the standard view of associates in consulting firms and law firms and so on was that their income had three equal components: the salary, the fringe benefits, and, you know, costs of space and so on. And then the other third was the partner's share. So that the partners are earning like a third of the associate's income. So would that be then not their services, but that would be a value they derive by virtue of owning the company?
Let me just make sure I understand your question. If you could just repeat for me sort of the very last
Okay,
bit
suppose I'm
work.
A partner, and I have actually I have no partner. Suppose I'm a lawyer, and I have someone working for me, and I pay him a modest salary, and I incur employment-related expenses. But a third of his salary actually, a third of his billings I take as my share. That's part of my income. So I have the hourly billing I do.
Okay.
I have a third of his hourly billing,
okay,
which I add to my income. So would that third be considered a return on a firm return? That would be a dividend. It's not my personal work. It's my share of the.
Well, I think that portion would go, yes, goes to increasing the profits of the business. And I think in that case, yes, that would be, a disguised income, or certainly it's income to you as the partner. But the key is that with respect to that income, the law firm would not be able to take a deduction for it. I see my time.
If it were a C corporation.
If it was a C corporation. Correct. Yeah. Correct.
All right. Hey, thank you very much,
thank
Ms.
Thank you so
Ashford.
Much.
So, Mr. Hartnett, do you have anything further?
Yes, Your Honor. Judge Hamilton asked the question, how is the firm to solve this question of identifying what's salary versus something else? We think that the tax court has helped us devise that principle in the case of law firm Richard A. Scher versus Commissioner. There, the tax court recognized that setting compensation is an exercise of business judgment that's not to be second-guessed absent abuse. That folds into our alternative argument here before
the... That's not true. That's not what we do in cases like Menard and Exacto. We look for evidence that, well, I mean, Menard, what was he getting, $20 million a year or something? And we looked carefully, and we thought, yeah, this is a terrific manager, and the company is profitable even though he controls it and takes a very big salary. So we said that was fine.
And
you could do the same thing here, right? But you don't even have a balance sheet. You don't have anything. You haven't made any effort to figure out what's firm income and what is the personal services of these people.
We did show that through testimony, Your Honor, that the founders worked enormous hours, that they provided consulting services in a variety of spheres.
But also, what about this stuff with the real estate, right? What's that about?
They own some real estate, and they provide
real estate. The real estate generates money. That surely is not their personal services, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
You never reported that as firm income to the IRS. There's just no excuse for that I can see.
Your Honor, I see my red light tells me my time is up.
Well, what's the answer? There's real estate income, that's firm income, that's not accounting, that's not personal services, and that's not reported to the IRS.
But it was reported. The consulting service income, it was all billed through the firm.
Yes, but this is real estate investment income. This is not personal services.
I don't understand the record that way, Your Honor.
Well, isn't it correct that the payments to PEM included return on capital, according to Mr. Salvador's testimony?
He was using capital in the sense of providing operating capital so that they needed money to keep running the firm for the next year. So
that's an explanation. It's tough to do that in the face of the tax court's findings. He called it a return on capital.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Hartman, and thank you, Ms. Ashford.